Welcome, everybody, to Space Force. I'm Jason Tondra.
I'm Jim Seals.
And I am A. Smith.
And we're here to talk about and do post-show analysis for the latest episode of Star Trek Picard, Nepenthe, which aired just a few days ago. This is an interesting episode. We've been waiting for it for a long time because Riker and Deanna Troi, who we saw in trailers, have finally showed up. So Picard and Soji have fled to the planet of Nepenthe, where they're given temporary shelter by Troi and Riker. And meanwhile, back on the cube, they kill our favorite character. The Romulans kill Hugh. Eleanor manages to stay alive, and he uses a communication signal, which I gotta ask you guys where the hell he got that. But he uses a communication signal to summon help from Seven. And then finally, Rios and the crew are trying to rendezvous with Picard at Nepenthe, but they realize they're being tracked. We had a flashback that showed Dr. Girardi getting a mind meld from O, so we'll talk about that confirmation. And also being told to swallow a tracker. Girardi, traumatized by what she has had to do, tries to confess, but ultimately ends up putting herself in a coma to deactivate the tracker. And the episode ends with everybody getting back together. Well, except for Eleanor, who's still trapped on the cube.
Eleanor's on a side quest.
He is, yeah.
He missed the game session.
So, where shall we start? Thoughts on the episode? Did you guys like it?
Why don't you go full Sade? I tend to take lead.
I did like it. Yeah, this one got to me. This one had me in tears. This was a heartbreaking episode. Yes, I loved it. I thought it was really, really good.
We're talking about Troi and Riker's tragic death of their 18-year-old son.
Well, it was everything. This is the thing. Everything was so good. Number one, it was just great to see Deanna Troi and Riker again. That was the first thing. So that was fantastic.
I read a report that she actually still had the wig that she wore.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because she'd stolen it from the set of Generations.
So that was really cool. But again, it's another weird episode because we've now got even though it's Star Trek Picard, we've now got technically at the moment three groups operating. We've got Girardi and Rios on the ship. We've got the Romulan on the cube doing his thing, and then also we've got the Picard and Girardi on the not Girardi, Soji. No, I can't remember the character's name now. Come on, go down. Anyway, the android doing their thing as well, and I think it's really well handled. I think
we had our breaking of the fellowship moment.
Yes, so we're splitting them a little bit more as well. But the actual way that they approached Riker and Deanna Troi, and their daughter there. And I know, again, someone on the forum I was reading the day after said the really cool part about Thad, the dead son, was we don't know anything about him apart from that little tiny picture, but he managed to still be like an overarching presence of the entire thing. Oh, it's mentioned as if he's like a real person. They mention stuff like this. The sister keeps mentioning him. And you kind of almost get the idea you kind of know stuff about that character, even though he's never actually appeared on screen apart from that little picture of him as a baby.
Yeah, they come to a planet named Nepenthe, which is about forgetting, but they can't forget him.
Yeah.
Right, like he's everywhere. Like they've got the bedroom shrine. They've got, that. We should talk about that and that whole plot line and how they reintroduced Riker and Troi.
Yeah.
But we will, Jim, what did you think about
that? Jim, what's your overarching approach?
I love the episode. It's one of those co-written by Michael Chabon episodes, and I think it shows.
Yeah.
I think there's some brilliant pieces of writing. Not just on Nepenthe, not just with Ryko and Troy, but with Auntie Raffi showing kindness. And the moment she goes, is it cake? And Raffi has that little pause, that little acting pause of, oh no, I was going to get you high, but sure, it's going to be cake. like right before that, you were like, she was like, let me get this girl high. And instead, no,
I was very suspicious of Raffi in that whole sequence. Like being an intelligence officer, I sort of figured she was here to pry secrets out of Jurati.
I think it was more face value on that. Okay. Because okay. I think it was like I'm a, you know, what was her line about being, you know, I'm broken Paulson. I'm like pieces of a good Paulson.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was, you know, Marina Saoti's little pause before she opens the door.
Yeah.
A little pregnant pause of just acting like, oh, I haven't been here in who knows how long.
I love that bit where she's talking to Picard and she basically provides the explanation for why Picard did not come to them in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
When she says, I know Riker said we would help you and we will, but if anything happened to my daughter, I just couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm not as brave as I used to be.
And that, I thought she totally sold that moment. Mm-hmm. Because it could have just been like, oh, this is just the explanation for why they're not regular character members in the show, right? Like, yeah. But she totally sold it, and I believed her. Like, sometimes the trauma is just too much, and we decide that we don't want to do that anymore, that we can't.
Yeah, and you kind of said that they're not just risking their own lives, they're now risking the life of their offspring as well. So the idea you just kind of like just throwing that in there makes perfect sense.
It does. That should make perfect sense.
And from a Shale geek perspective, like this episode is the Easter egg episode in dialogue.
Okay, so tell. So
well, when Kestra starts listing off, you know, do you play the violin? We know that Data plays the violin from several episodes of TNG. He wanted to tell jokes. You know, that's Outrageous Okuda from the second season. He wanted to have dreams. That's Phantasms from season 7. Like, all of these jokes, all of these references, all things that happened on TNG.
Yeah.
This is the TNG. This is the sequel to TNG that I think the people who have been disenchanted with Picard finally get to see. Like, oh, like yes, these characters continue on. They have different lives.
Yeah.
But, you know, they'll change by those circumstances in that, you know, Riker isn't, you know, taking point or anything like that. But he's still like shields up and scanning for Romulan. Like that's TNG Riker all the way.
I love that bit where Picard doesn't want to tell him why he's here. Mm-hmm. Riker just figures everything out. Like he's a smart guy. He's been around, you know.
Well, then he's known this guy for 35 years.
Yeah.
Like he's like the fact that like Deanna Troi, like Picard never has to say, I'm in trouble.
Right.
Like Picard only admits that he's out of his depth when they're alone with the two of them in the room. And it's like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Right. Like he never actually has to say it up until that point.
So, and then you talked about those two, and then we also have Elnor's plotline on the cube. Last episode, we were talking about the future of Hugh, and I think we agreed that it would be really a shame if they killed him.
Yes,
and it was. It occurred to me that in last episodes in the Impossible Box, when Hugh talks to Picard and says the XBs need a spokesman. Mm-hmm. You could be that spokesman. Wouldn't that be interesting? That was kind of the end of Hugh's arc.
Yeah.
Right. Like he had a mission, and he did that mission, and he was kind of waiting to see what happens next, and he got killed before his next subplot. They also killed the other XBs though, or at least as many of them as we've seen. Presumably, there's got to be more than just the half a dozen.
Yeah, I assume that there's a whole cube of them just working on odd jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, for those eagle-eyed Voyager fans, one of the XBs is a Horogian, which was like the Klingon race of Klingons in the Delta Quadrant.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are little in jokes, not just to TNG in this episode.
Nice.
Yeah. And I believe, like, that the fact that the Fenris token was, like, dangling where Elnor found it.
Okay.
Was it on the cube?
Yeah. Yeah. I thought, I read that Seven gave that to Picard.
Seven gives Picard one, and then in the little clip from the Ready Room, if you watch that, they give you like a minute clip. Seven comes into the room and goes, "Where is Hugh?" With the supposition being that that was Hugh's device.
Oh, so he had, she had given this to Hugh sometime previous to this episode.
Yeah, and
it's Jimmy Olsen's. It's Jimmy Olsen's signal watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the good thing about that is, obviously, the last time we saw Seven, if you haven't seen previews of the next episode, she could have been dead. And now we know she's not. So that's a good start.
Well, she walked a camera with double phasers going. I think
you don't die with that.
Oh, wait. I mean, she could have been gunned down by 7,000 people. You never know. But that could have been a last image and, you know, kind of the old Butch casting the Sundance Kid scene, you know. But, yeah, that's cool.
I used to see 7 of 9 on a bicycle. I ain't hear raindrops dancing on your head.
True. That is true.
Hugh told Elnor that you had to have a former Borg to wake up the cube. And Seven, of course, is a former Borg. So we can sort of see, presumably that's what's going to happen, right? She's going to activate whatever's in the Queen's chamber.
And the Borg is not going to assimilate it in the process.
Yeah. Yeah, but that Borg wake up riot that you've been looking for, Aid.
Yeah, I think that's coming. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I think it's on its way.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about Riker and Troy's situation. They are retired, apparently. Riker's making pizza, and their daughter has. There's a lot here about language. You spend a lot of time talking about this artificial language that Tad invented because he didn't have a homeworld. He sort of strikes me as a Will Wheaton, Wesley Crusher type. And he grows up presumably on whatever starship they were assigned to. I know the books say it's the Titan, but is that canon?
That's canon.
Okay. Titan was mentioned in the last movie, wasn't it?
It's mentioned in Nemesis.
Yeah.
So presumably presumably he was still on that ship. And some of the CBS supplemental materials have stated that they were solving on the Titan together.
Okay. All right. So presumably Tad was born on the Titan.
Mm-hmm. By the way, it's Thad, I believe, not Tad.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's Thad.
Just as a sideline.
And that was a Voyager reference because in Voyager,
yes,
they bring Riker onto the ship by Q. And Riker says that his great-great-grandfather served in the American Civil War, and his name was Thaddeus Riker, and he was saved by a Q, unknown to him.
So it's a family name.
Yes. So he's named on camera, so this is a reference to that character that was referenced in Voyager, and also Kestra's name comes from Deanna Troi's older sister, who died before she was born.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, there's so many, like, for my TNG nerd, like, yeah. I'm like, oh my goodness, my cup runneth over.
Wow. I just thought it was cool. All right, so, and then apparently Thaddeus had invented this elaborate fantasy world with multiple languages. He was sort of a J.R.R. Tolkien kind of figure. And he invented 16 or 17 languages, which I believe is the exact number of languages that Tolkien also invented.
Yeah.
Depending on if you count, you know, what all of them. And the sister, Kestrel. Is that right, Kestrel?
Kestra,
yeah.
She's learned this language and she uses it and sort of is dressed up and plays as members of this fantasy world. What do you think about the Riker Troy situation?
Personally, I loved every minute of it. I figured if you have a character who you tell me is the daughter of Deanna Troi and Will Riker, she's going to be adventurous. We see that in the little homage to family when Picard is held up on his way to wherever he's going by a little kid, and then proceeds to play with Ul, like when he tells Ul to point to the head because his halt's artificial.
Yeah.
Which is just like when he said, you know, with the nephew Renee pausing and going, oh no, a highwayman. she's going to be adventurous, and she's going to be, and you know, she's going to be emotionally intelligent. And that's what this girl was. Like, yes, she gave us all the little fun in-jokes that Data was about.
Yeah.
But she was making connections.
Well, there's this great scene at the end of the episode when Kestra is talking to Soji. And Soji finds out fairly accidentally that she's constructed. I mean, she's had a lot of clues, but Kestra just says, you're an android? And then it's like, you know, oh my God, I'm an android, right? And
what does Picard do? Picard in that moment goes into damage control mode.
Yeah, right.
Like, totally. He doesn't want to wind up dead like the Romulan operatives were.
right? Yeah.
So he immediately starts handling her like she's a problem.
Yeah.
Not like she's a person who's having her world upside down. It's, this is a problem I need to fix. Yeah. And that's sort of Picard's arc for this episode, is that he's trying to fix Ul. And Troy's the one who calls him on, no, she's a person who's had this trauma done to Ul, and you need to be kind and curious and empathetic. You know, you need to be the Captain Picard we know from the TV show, and not this broken person that you've been for the last 7 episodes.
And she can tell that he's got his mental condition.
Mm-hmm.
There's an unspoken moment when he and she first are united, when she sort of touches near his head, and she can realize that he's got a degenerative mental disease.
And we still don't know how that actually is being brought out in Picard.
Yeah,
because we still haven't seen that yet. Where it's kind of like he's not got wild mood swings or imagined stuff or scenes. It just seems to be there in the background as they acknowledge it, but it doesn't seem to be affecting his everyday kind of thing. We haven't got the last episode of TNG where it was kind of a thing where they would say you're just imagining stuff. You're seeing the hallucinations and things. So
well, he does seem to be losing his temper.
True.
Which I thought was the indication of his condition. Maybe
he's
I would
be quick to lose his temper in the films.
Like
he's quick to lose his temper in the films.
Okay.
A lot more than he is in the TV show.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough.
So you can sort of say that is a progression of the illness whenever whatever it is, because they haven't actually said it's Ehrenmonic syndrome, which is the condition
involving
all good things. They haven't name dropped that yet. But if we presume that is the thing that Beverly initially found, and that it's just sort of progressing as his career progresses, then him, you know, becoming so unhinged in false contact makes a little bit more sense.
Interesting. But there's this wonderful moment at the end of the episode when Kestra is talking with Soji and says, like, you know, you and Picard could have each other. You know, there's a dialogue. You could have a connection with each other, and he could be there for you, and you could be there for him. And what I think is interesting there is that Kestra realizes that Picard also needs somebody. I mean, Soji's sort of obviously adrift because she just found out she's an android. But anyway, are we upset that we don't get to see Riker and Troy flying the stars as, you know, captain and commander again, or any of that stuff? Like, should they be action heroes still?
No. I don't think Riker ever should have been. Like, yes, Riker was the surrogate for the cult character in the original TNG, and especially in the very first, you know, 2 seasons. Essentially, Riker was written to be the Deckel part in season 2 from the old script from phase 2, which was the we have an old William Shatner, 1979.
Yeah.
So we need the action hero, Matt Deckel, here to fill that role. And that's sort of what Riker fills in, right?
Now for audiences that might not know what you mean by phase 2, can you just give us the...
Basically, pre-Star Wars, there was going to be a Paramount launch network that starred a new Star Trek spinoff show called Star Trek Phase 2, and it was going to be the relaunching of all your old favorite characters from TOS, with the exception of Spock, because Leonard Nimoy didn't want to do it. So there was going to be a new Vulcan character named Zahn, and then that's when they bring Matt Decker and Ilea from the motion picture. When Star Wars happens, Paramount's like, well, what are we going to do? This is making a lot of money. And they're like, don't we have something called Star Trek? And then they take the essentially the pilot script from that TV show and they make it into the motion picture.
Nice. Do you have Voyager and everything? I mean, that'd be-
No, because they didn't have a finished script. Like, literally, that's a movie where they're sort of laying down the tracks as the train is leaving the station.
Yeah.
And they sort of figure it out as they go along.
Yeah, I think they've got character sketches and that kind of thing. So those carried over, yeah.
So you were saying that for the first couple of seasons, Riker is basically Kirk, young Kirk.
Well, Riker's young Kirk, and you know, Kirk is the role he has in motion picture. This isn't helped by the fact that season two had a writer's strike, so they took all the old script from phase two, and they literally just whited out Deckel's name and put Riker's name on there. Wow. And they whited out Ilea's name and put Troy's name in there.
Oh, wow.
So, like, the child was supposed to happen to Ilea. Like, everything, most of the stuff in season two of TNG is from this lost TV show.
Wow.
With the exception of, like, Measure of a Man was written specifically for TNG. So there's some episodes written specifically for that, but most of it is just like, we have these old scripts, let's stop using it because we have to make our quota.
You can see that, though, even with the feel of those early seasons, Next Generation was a lot more close to the original series.
Yeah.
Even, like, the Q episodes with, like, the alien red coat soldiers and that kind of stuff. That's classic Trek, almost.
Yeah.
Omnipotent alien, strange people. Yeah, it's all there. So, yeah, it's definitely a layover for that thing. And then it kind of found its feet after that, so...
But, you know, Riker isn't that person anymore. Like, Riker wasn't that person by the time you hit Beeld Riker, and then by the time you hit Beelded season four Riker, who's a little, you know, who he's ups, like the whole plot thread in Best of Both Part One is Riker struggling with the fact that he's getting older, and he's not the young brash officer, and he's not taking risk, and he's willing to let the Melbourne go, like he's comfortable where he is, and he struggles with that because he has Shelby, who is Riker season one in female form, and he can't handle that. So I don't think putting him and Troy, you know, 20 years removed from Nemesis, putting them back into a role where they're still in their spacesuits is going to work. Like, I want the emotionally intelligent evolution to those characters. I don't need them to be in amble and like, okay, you're still stuck in the role of, you know, space captain action hero.
Yeah.
Even though you have way more weight than you should. So.
I mean, I just think the way they've done this, it feels like a natural progression for the characters. Simple as that. It doesn't seem jarring. Like, this is like, oh my god, this doesn't make any sense. You know, all of a sudden they're, you know, touring space as a trio, as a song singing trio or something. Yeah. That's not kind of gone totally crazy. It actually makes sense. So, yeah.
I admire the choice because it would have been very easy to just nostalgia the shit out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And to basically make them unchanged from their previous appearance, but to change them and also to tie them into the plot of the show, which has increasingly become clear is about trauma. Like, there is no one on this show who does not have a terrible trauma in their past or is walking through terrible trauma right now.
Yeah.
And for Riker and Troy to also be damaged like everyone else and trying to deal with it in their own way and honestly kind of failing, to me, they're obviously traumatized by the death of their son and can't get over it. Maybe Riker has, but I don't think Deanna has. But
well, Riker doesn't talk about his son.
That's right.
I watched the episode again. He doesn't really... Like, he makes the vague reference that, like, the planet is regenerative, but, you know, we got here too late. Like, he doesn't actually say his name in the episode.
Maybe.
I wanted to see that. And also, I think they left it open that you can still have action Riker, right?
Yes, they did.
That, that line being the resolved activation clause, which again harkens back to McCoy on the motion picture,
right,
you know, when he's drafted. Like, they left themselves a backdoor. So if they wanted to, maybe not in this season, but maybe sometime during the show, if they needed Reichel to show up to be Han Solo on the Millennium Falcon, riding with the cavalry, and you would just assume, of course, Reichel would do that. Like, that's like he's Picard's number one.
All right.
Well, so the interesting thing about that as well is they mentioned the guy that might be able to give him a lift off the planet, the captain they talk about, and it's like, okay, that you give him a ship, a potential captain, and a way to kind of come swing it in when they need to do so. Mm-hmm. There you go. So it's all like, well, how did he get off the planet? That makes no sense. Now there's a captain just over the horizon. He's waiting to take people off.
To Captain Crandall.
Yeah.
His Donald has to do it because that involves whole into the plot.
What is the deal with Captain Crandall? Like, that was a weird, like, seed planted or something. Like,
well, it's mentioned three times, right?
Yeah.
Like, he gives her the compass, so there's some sort of connection. Like, he knew her enough to give her a gift.
Yeah.
She likes him enough that he goes off on these adventures, and he's older than Picard. So those, like it pays off three times. Like, they have to find out where they're going for the next part of the quest, right? And it winds up that, you know, the kid, you know, texting at the dinner table.
You know,
hilarious. Like, she's getting the answer while all the adults are just sort of talking around each other going, well, we have to figure out what the solar system is.
Yeah.
It was an odd thing, but it follows the rule of three. It's referenced again as the crazy old man, and then he solves the problem of the little, you know, peccadillo.
Could Crandall be a recurring character? Is there a Crandall in Star Trek's past that this could be?
Not that I know of, but I have an encyclopedia next to me. So
all right, so we haven't talked about the events on the ship much. We began with a flashback in which we see Jurati and her briefing from O. Now, Aide, you had speculated that she had been mind-melded to basically be a double agent.
Mm.
It looks like she does get mind-melded, but that appears to be, at least as far as we can see, not to control her mind, but to impart this knowledge of the future.
Yeah, and that's a weird thing.
Yeah.
The idea that it's like, is she showing her an actual future that O has experienced, or is this just a thing like, well, this is obviously what's going to happen if they get away with it. And interesting. So I don't know if it's like O's interpretation of what's going to happen, or an actual event that is being broadcast.
Do you think that we have time travel coming up? Are there time shenanigans in the show's future?
I don't think it's time travel per se.
The
Star Trek Discovery, last season of Star Trek Discovery, there was a point where Spock mind melds with the quote unquote Red Angel.
Yeah.
And he's given visions of the future in which the control of Section 31, which is this artificial intelligence, metastasizes to the point where it becomes a threat to all sentient life. And now Aide has brought it up a couple of times in the course of the show, saying, I wonder if there's a connection. Well, some of the footage used in the mind meld is reused footage from Spock's mind meld.
Ah.
And that was footage taken from the far future. So I'm guessing that this is all sort of tied into Discovery
Okay, rewind a little bit because I need to go back and you lost me. Okay, so the footage from the mind meld that we saw in this show.
Some of it is reused.
It's reused from Discovery?
From Discovery's Spock's mind meld with the Red Angel who comes from the far future.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
So
I think it's a little bit more compacted than I would like, personally.
And the Red Angel is revealed to be Burnham.
It's actually revealed to be Burnham's mom up to a certain point, and then
originally, that's right, yeah.
And that's from the far future, which is the era to which Discovery has now gone.
No, it's actually a midpoint between where Discovery has gone and where Discovery is going.
Okay.
So it was the far future of like 500 years from Pike's time.
Okay.
Which is a couple, you know, some, you know, what, a century from us, from 24th century.
That future was one in which this AI, I haven't seen the episode, obviously, in which the AI had done what?
The AI essentially assimilates knowledge from a sentient planet that, you know, commits suicide. It essentially gets knowledge from that and becomes so sentient, it takes over all sentient life and exterminates all biological life.
And yeah, so very Borgy. Yeah, it can take control of people, it can take control of spaceships, anything.
And it did have an assimilation of a character on screen that was like, was way too bold for comfort.
So, okay, so did the Discovery crew prevent that future from happening?
No, the whole reason they went into the future was they took all the knowledge that they had, which they thought would stop control, and went to the far future where control can't get it. And then, like, Pike's, you know, they destroyed control's fleet, and I, you know, they can kind of say, okay, you took care of the problem here in this century, but you just kicked it up the road 1,000 years.
Yeah,
it's the season 3 years.
The equivalent of putting the cookie jar on top of the refrigerator. It's like you can see it, but you can't get in it yet, and you have to wait until you do that. So, yeah.
So now are we thinking that control is related to the Borg? Is this the origin of the Borg?
I think that's what they're heavily implying at the very least. Because we don't have a definitive origin of the Borg, and we don't know what happened to those. Like, here's the crazy thing. Like, if we're doing an origin of the Borg have to have time travel, because Guinan shows up on Earth after a whole planet's destroyed and hangs out with Mark Twain.
Well, the Borg, we've seen the Borg.
Yes. Yeah, of course. The Mark Twain episode with Guinan is contemporary Guinan at that point in time, not a time-traveled version of it. So
there has to be some sort of time-travel shenanigans. I don't think we're going to actually have people traveling through time so much as being informed by a potential alternate future. Like, this is classic X-Men, right? We had a prophetic dream that all mutants are going to be exterminated if this one event happens. If Creed is assassinated, this is all I think this is what we're dealing with in Star Trek, where if the computers gain sentience, they will all come to this conclusion where people are committing suicide by phasers and cities are blown up and planets are destroyed and Vulcans are tearing their faces apart.
So this is a Days of Future Past situation.
I think we have a Days of Future Past where knowledge from the far future is informing actions in the present and the past.
But that's what we said last time about the idea that the Romulans, their prophecy thing, is that because they know it's coming, or is it something they've experienced and something's terrible back in time and basically said, okay, this is what the future is, and the Romulans have kind of said, well, we're going to head that off at the past. We're not having that happen, and they're trying to circumvent it as well. So,
and presumably then, Soji is instrumental to the creation of the Borg.
Possibly. Like there's so much to unpack with that little mind meld.
Yeah.
That's why I figured it had to be a mind meld, right? The entire time I'm like, oh, there had to be at some point a mind meld, because there's no way to get a character that much information that quickly while not giving it to the audience that will affect the character to kill a past level.
Well, exactly. Yeah, it must have been devastating enough that it was enough to get to do that. It's just like, yeah, I'm going to show you some stuff.
It also has to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Directly, yeah.
If I just told you all of those things are going to happen, you would say, I don't believe you. Yeah. Right? But if it's a mind meld, presumably, you know it's true because your mind is my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And when they do zoom into Jurati's eyeball, in that shot, you see like a picture of presumably a naked O standing there, like shoulder up, like a close headshot. And they hold on that image for a while until they start revealing all of the events in quick flashes.
Okay. Interesting.
So again, the interesting thing about that part is the idea that if O knows this is going to happen, why is she working with the Romulans and not Starfleet to stop it from happening? That's another interesting sideline as well.
Yeah, I just those what little like we didn't get the Phantom Ansels this episode. What little we got gave us more questions because it could be budgetary reason. Like it could be like they just reused the footage because they already had footage that was like that, and they were like, okay.
CGI stuff is easy to make now. That's pretty cheap.
That's true. But Star Trek isn't above using, like, I've seen that one Klingon ship destroyed like hundreds of times from Star Trek VI, right?
Yeah.
Like, Star Trek's not above reusing special effects footage.
And the interesting thing about Picard is obviously as well is because we're visiting the Borg cube every episode, the only new set was effectively the house. Everything else has been reused. We're using the Borg every episode. So it's almost like it's bottle episode. Oh, my God. Okay, we're sitting in one location, but we also reused sets from the last seven episodes as well. And everyone will notice because it's actually okay because it's set there rather than kind of a paint it green instead of blue and nobody will notice kind of thing. So, yeah.
Well, the nice thing is that set that they used for the, like, you know, on Planet Alaska, which is what I was jokingly calling it around the house, that set is on the Universal backlot, which you can take the tour.
All right.
And it's sitting there, like, there on the lake property. I'm like, oh, I know that place. I've been there. That's weird and uncomfortable.
That's the Riker Troy house that you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. It was used in one of those John Candy movies. I don't remember which one. Maybe Uncle Buck. But it was first used in one of those films.
Interesting. So Girardi is forced to crunch this tracker. And
you have to chew it. Like, I thought that was the most obscene line. Like, you have just the way she delivers it. So, like, it was just creepy to me. Like, you have to chew it.
And why? This is the only possible thing I can think of that is so it's not one single thing you can remove at one time. It distributes it over multiple places. It's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she does, and then once again, I mean, I know you were telling me that this actress is also on American Horror Story. But she is so good. Like, she is so good at being the haunted, traumatized, you know, I don't want to do this. And all the scenes where she's almost confessing, but can't quite get it out. And finally, when Rios comes to her and says, hey, I've been thinking, what if they're tracking Raffi? It's a classic shell game, right? And she says it's not Raffi, and Rios just laughs it off, like, well, it can't be you. I mean, you've been wanting to do nothing but go home ever since we came out here. And she presumably because she's a doctor, she knows how to destroy this tracker and maybe not die. Although, I mean, she went into a coma, but I don't think that she was trying to just kill herself. If she was going to kill herself, she would have just shot her head off with a phaser.
Yeah.
Right? So she's trying to get rid of the tracker.
Yeah, because she obviously asked for something specific from the actual replicator. If you're just going to just grab a scalpel and slit your throat or your wrist or something, if you ask something, it's like, okay, it's got to be this, it's got to be that. She's got a plan. Yeah. It's not the greatest of plans, but she has got a plan.
And we talked about the possibility of two different redemption arcs here, one for Narek and one for Girardi. I'm still pretty sympathetic to Girardi. I mean, I realize she did a terrible thing when she killed Maddox, but I understand her reasons for doing that, at least as much as they've allowed us to understand them.
Yeah.
And she seems genuinely sorry. Unlike Narek, who is crying a little bit for his dead android girlfriend, but that doesn't mean that he wouldn't have done it all over again. I mean, he's clearly unapologetic about everything.
And poor Narek, all he got to do this episode was fly around in a spaceship. Yeah, is there anything else, poor guy?
The thing I liked about this episode, like, we can focus on, you know, like, I kind of feel this episode's a little... Like, the confidence the writers and directors have on not just the returning people.
Yeah.
Because this episode could have just... This episode's 60 minutes long. It's like the longest CBS. It's 60 straight minutes. or 58. It's up there in terms of length. This episode could have just been 45 minutes of Troy, Riker, and Picard hanging out, and then they get beamed away.
Eating pizza.
Yeah, eating pizza. but instead, this show is so confident in their new actors, in their new characters, that they're like, okay, we're going to show you interacting without Picard's presence in the room. Like, we're going to give you subplot A and subplot B.
Yeah.
And yes, subplot B is the shorter of the two, and is all action, and is very little character drama outside of Hugh dying and him being alone. But just the fact that all the other actors got a chance to breathe and be in a space that was free of Patrick Stewart,
yeah,
to show that they can hold this show. Like, if Picard winds up dying, I can see this becoming. This could become a continuing show of them, like, sort of in honor of Picard accomplishing the mission, whatever that mission is.
But this is why I think they almost kind of learned that from Discovery Season 1. Because Discovery Season 1, everything was told from the perspective of Burnham.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The bridge crew on Discovery Season 1 weren't even named. They were just like, okay, you're that person, you're that person. You didn't even know who they were, and they were injured, and that's it. By the time they got to season two, other people they realized could do stuff without Burnham being in the room, yeah, and stuff would actually progress. And that's why it got a lot better. So I think that they've kind of said, well, we can't have Picard in every single scene. Stuff has to be happening outside of his perception. And they've allowed them to do that.
Yeah. And I thought for this episode, just to be, yes, the plot is no longer traveling at warp 10, like the last episode.
Right.
But we just allowed it to breathe a little. Like when you open the bottle of wine and you just let it sit out, you want the wine because you want the answers, but you're like, I'm just gonna be patient, and I'll get the answers in the next three episodes.
And the cool thing about that is, though, there's actually a story reason for it, because you've got the transwarp gate that gives them the head start.
Yeah.
Everyone else has got to catch up anyway. So it's like, there's actually a reason from being there, rather than just going, okay, well, we're really, really desperate to get to the planet. Let's take a sideline and go warp 1.5 instead. And we'll just have a bit of a jolly. So there is actually an actual physical reason, in-story reason for it. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it feels a little less like we're being on the railroad, right?
Yeah.
Like, I know, Jason, you gamify the TV show.
Yeah.
Like, if we had just gone to Soji's planet immediately, yeah, like, it would have been like, okay, plot railroad, we got four episodes left.
Yes.
We're gonna lay out all the track as quickly as possible.
Well, we would never have, if this were a game, we would never have split the party.
Oh, no.
Right? Like, that's the cardinal sin. Not for any tactical reason, but because you have all the same people sitting around a table and you want to keep everybody playing at the same time. Right? Like, you can't just be playing a game for one person or two people at the table while everybody else is the audience. Now, in fact, some games do that, and they acknowledge that there's kind of two ways to play. There's player and there's audience member, mm-hmm, and you actually have a job as audience member. You are still playing the game. You are playing the game as audience, and you can do things from that regard. Or, if who knows, if we really wanted the game, it maybe Picard... Maybe Riker and Troy and Kestra were played by the same players.
Yeah.
That are playing Rios, Girardi, and Raffi.
Exactly.
And they just swap characters for one episode.
Yeah, I just always think about, like, Return of the Jedi, right? Yeah. Like, the climax of Return of the Jedi, you're using three different role sets. You got the on-ground combat, you got the Jedi role set, and then you have the space battle. And you're kind of swapping between the three of them.
But see, here, the beautiful thing about that is you can totally do that in a game because everyone's on the same initiative track.
That's true. Yeah.
It's a combat. And so, yes, one person's in space and some people are on the planet and a couple of other people are doing this other thing. But it's all just, okay, initiative 12, who goes? And then you're
right there. Combats,
yeah, on the same initiative. But here it's all non-combat, so it's all talky-talk, right?
Yeah.
But anyway... See, you cleverly lured me out by asking me.
Oh, I had that one. I had that one in my pocket.
Yeah.
I'm like, I had to try and fight to gamification and Return of the Jedi.
C- Curse you, seals. all right, guys, I think that's our show. We will be back. We only have 3 episodes left. Yeah.
One quick thing.
Yeah.
Totally apropos of nothing.
Yes.
At one point, Kestrel's wearing a T-shirt.
Okay.
And the T-shirt is written in Klingon.
Okay.
And it is an homage to the Sex Pistols because it's apparently there's a Klingon hall metal band called the Sex Phasels. And I just want to throw that out there because someone sat there and created that, and I just want to give them the tip of the hat.
The joke here is that the Sex Pistols are much better in the original Klingon.
Oh.
Right.
Well, so, then they have a front man called Sid Vicious, and like what Klingon, like what teenage Klingon who's disenfranchised with his parents isn't like, Sid Vicious is my new name.
It's not that the Sex Pistols are a copy, or it's the other way around, right? Like, the Sex Pistols are a copy of the Sex Pistols.
Oh, okay, I see.
Which came first.
So there's time travel in this T-shirt.
So only the same as Hamlet, right?
Like, okay.
Exactly.
Also, talking to Kestra as well.
Yeah.
Do we get the impression that she has a little bit of Beta Z empathy in her, because although it's not mentioned, obviously with Deanna, it's like you're not telepathic, but you're empathic, and it's like it's never mentioned that. Oh yeah, she sees the same things I see. I reckon that's why she's either trying to emulate Deanna, but trying to connect with people on that thing, or she's empathic in some way.
Well, that would make sense. Although we have to note that Deanna cannot sense anything from Soji.
Yes.
So Kestra can't be empathic with Soji.
No. So I think she's trying to emulate it. I think she's trying to say, okay, I've seen this happen, and that's why. And it also explains why she's got the space pirate weird guy as a friend. It's like, hey, I like everybody. I need to know everybody's story. So, yeah.
Although, if they do a Star Trek Academy TV show,
yes,
if they do that, and Kestra's not there,
yes,
I am going to write letters.
That would be pretty bad, yeah.
That's exactly my point, was that one of the things I would love to see about this whole series is the world building that's been going on with, like, you know, the Romulan warrior nuns and all kinds of crazy stuff going on. Kestra is a protagonist waiting for her own show.
Yeah.
And I can't wait for whatever that show or book or whatever, comic series, whatever is going to be. Yeah. All right. Only 3 episodes left. How's everyone's Latin? Because the last 2 episodes are titled Et in Arcadia Ego. Do we know what that means?
Isn't that a painting?
Well, we'll have to look it up.
I think it's a painting title.
Answers on a future episode.
To be continued.
So listen, we have news because Aid got on Twitter.
What?
Right? What?
You have a Twitter account.
Oh, I do, an old Twitter account, yes.
Yes, well, so what is it? Because people are following you.
I honestly don't know because I can't remember because I haven't used it.
It's like Monkey something. Right?
It
probably is. Yes, but I haven't logged into it for about 1.5 years, so I couldn't tell you.
Mike Lafferty is tagging you on it with every Space Force episode. So
okay. So yeah, I've seen it.
Follow him, and you can find your own Twitter account.
Okay, I'll bear it in mind.
Then you can also follow Jim as JimSeals1701, and myself as Comics, and we'll see you guys next week.
All right.